freely. And then my own personal website is called Planted at Home. I live and work and garden and toil from home, and so that seemed appropriate.
And that's plantedathome.com?
Plantedathome.com.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
We are out of time once again. I'm Alex Smith. Get links for this show and my show blog at ecoshock.info. Back the program and get free downloads at the website ecoshock.org. Welcome to all our new listeners, and thank you for listening and caring about your world.
And it is 11 a.m. You are tuned to KBOO in Portland. Coming right up, stay tuned for Health Watch with Dr. David Naiman. Today's guest is Dr. Martin Blaser, author of the book Missing Microbes, How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues. And at 11:30, it's Madness Radio. Host Will Hall has a guest, his name, and he is the Swedish psychiatrist Carina Håkansson, founder of Family Care Foundation, which promotes treating mental health issues in family homes instead of sterile institutions.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Drones in Oregon, Myths, Facts, and Futures, a community forum about the use of drones. This community forum on the use of drones will take place Thursday, August 7th from 7 to 9:30 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, Southwest 12th and Salmon in Portland. Speakers include retired Army Colonel Ann Wright, Brian Whiteside, Peter Lumsdaine, and Oregon State Representative Jennifer Williamson. Again, that's Drones in Oregon, a community forum on Thursday, August 7th at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. More information at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
First chattel slavery, then Jim Crow, now mass incarceration. Over half of our prison population are people of color. Tune into Prison Pipeline to hear Jonina Abron Irvin and Lorenzo Irvin talk about prison slavery. That's Prison Pipeline, August 4th at 6:30 p.m.
And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffee House.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. For 3 billion years, bacteria were the sole living inhabitants on Earth. Today, humans host around 100 trillion bacterial cells, outnumbering human cells 10 to 1. The 3 pounds of bacteria that we contain forms what is called the microbiome, the ecosystem of microorganisms on which we all depend. But what if this elaborate community of organisms was threatened? Today's guest, Dr. Martin Blaser, spells out exactly that scenario in his new book, Missing Microbes, How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues. Dr. Blaser is director of the Human Microbiome Program at New York University, former president of the Infectious Disease Society of America, and is the co-founder of the Bellevue Literary Review. His work has appeared in The New Yorker, Nature, The New York Times, The Washington Post, and The Wall Street Journal, and he has studied the role of bacteria in human disease now for more than 30 years. Welcome to Health Watch, Dr. Martin Blaser.
Thank you for having me. My pleasure.
So our understanding of bacteria in the human body is really in its infancy. Can you put that in context for us, how little we know about bacteria compared to other things that we do know in medicine?
Well, we have known that we have microbes living in us since the 17th century, since the time of von Leeuwenhoek, when he looked at his own spit under the new microscope. In the 19th century, Pasteur and the others began to show us the importance of bacteria, and mostly we have focused on pathogenic bacteria, the bacteria that cause diseases, like the bacteria that causes tuberculosis or cholera or typhoid fever. And even though we knew that we had organisms living in us, it was really a black box until maybe the last 10 years or so.
And it's interesting when you talk about how specialized and sophisticated bacteria are. Even the type of bacteria on the top of our tongue is different than the bacteria on the underside of our tongue, for instance.
We are a remarkably diverse ecosystem. In fact, we are composed of multiple ecosystems. Even on our skin, we have multiple ecosystems with some grand divisions like moist skin, dry skin, oily skin. They each have their own predominant bacteria, and the skin on the arm is different than the skin on the ball of the foot.
So you mention, or you describe bacteria as another one of our vital organs. So can you summarize what some of the things we do know that they do for us as this extra organ, essentially?
Yeah, well, just getting back to your earlier thought, really, we mostly ignored them in medical science until recently. We kind of thought of them as passengers, that they were kind of living on us, but they didn't do much for us. But now it's becoming clear that they do a lot for us. We know that they help us in digesting food. They make vitamins for us. They train our immune system. They help protect us against these pathogenic organisms. And we're just beginning to learn many, many of the functions that they have. It's a very active part of the human body.
Even things such as neurotransmitters, which we used to think were solely produced in the brain, we're realizing are produced in our guts.
They're produced in our guts, or they are produced by our own intestinal cells, but after receiving a signal from the bacteria. So the bacteria, in essence, are talking to our cells and saying, okay, make some more of this or make less of that. They're part of all of our signaling mechanisms within our body.
And you also sort of push back in Missing Microbes against the idea that bacteria are simple or primitive. What are we learning that would counter that narrative that they are primitive organisms?
Well, for one thing, they've been around, as you say, since the beginning of life on Earth. Probably goes back close to 4 billion years, and they have survived. We humans, Homo sapiens, has been around for about 200,000 years, just to look at the difference in scale, 4,200,000. So they know what they're doing. And the other very important thing is that bacteria are incredibly diverse. If we compared your human genome to my human genome, we're 99.9% similar. But if we compare our microbiomes, the bacteria that we carry, you know, just in terms of who they are, we are extremely diverse. I mean, it's even hard to compare some of the bacteria that all of us have. The variation in numbers between you and me could be as much as 6 logs, just
wow.
As an example.
So you're not against antibiotics, but you do believe that the overuse of antibiotics is fueling what you call our modern plagues. What are some of these conditions that you think there's some research to suggest a link to overuse of antibiotics and their rise?
Yeah, so let me go back a step. Because there were so many terrible pathogens, the invention of antibiotics, their discovery and deployment starting essentially in the 1930s and 1940s was miraculous. So many people's lives were saved. It made surgery safe. It made it possible to do transplantation and give chemotherapy. Antibiotics have tremendously affected medicine for the better. On the other hand, they used to be reserved for very, very sick people, and now antibiotics are being used more and more and more. In fact, in 2010, according to surveys by the Center for Disease Control, there were 258 million courses of antibiotics used in the United States. That's for a population of 300 million people. What that means is that there were five courses of antibiotics for every six people, and that is going on year after year after year. So the amount of use is tremendous. The average child in the U.S. probably gets three courses of antibiotics by the time they're two. That's across all the children in the U.S. By the time they're 10, it's about 10 courses of antibiotics. By the time they're 20, it's 17 courses of antibiotics. That's just the averages. Of course, there's variation, but it shows you the huge, huge scale of antibiotics. So we know that antibiotics act against bacteria, and I'm a medical doctor. I was taught and I assumed for all these years what everybody has always thought is that you take an antibiotic, it perturbs things for a while, and then everything bounces back to normal. That's what we used to think. But now it's becoming clear that everything doesn't bounce back to normal, that there could be long-term effects from the antibiotics. And that's where my idea, which I expressed in Missing Microbes, comes in, is that now since the antibiotic era, which began in the 1940s in essence, there are all these diseases that have risen dramatically. Asthma, food allergies, obesity, diabetes, juvenile diabetes, celiac disease, inflammatory bowel disease, autism. The list goes on and on. So either for 10 diseases, you have 10 different causes, or perhaps there's one thing that's fueling all of them. And my theory, which I express in Missing Microbes, is that we are perturbing our microbiome early in life, in childhood, when it should be developing normally. And that's the fuel that's causing all these diseases to go out of control.
So when we talk about antibiotic overuse, how should we go about determining when it is overuse and when it is appropriate use? I know that you have the problem on the one hand of overprescription, but you also on the other hand have a person coming in who wants an antibiotic even though the doctor may not want to give it to them.
Yeah, right. So that's a critical question. And to answer that, first let me go back to some of the numbers. I gave you the numbers for antibiotic use in the U.S., but in Sweden, they use antibiotics much less. In fact, at every age, they're using about 40% of the antibiotics we're using. So the average child in Sweden at the age of 10 has received four courses of antibiotics, whereas we've received 10. Now, the Swedes are just as healthy as we are. Maybe they're even healthier. And that immediately suggests that 60% of the antibiotics we're using are actually unnecessary. And this is one of the reasons I wrote Missing Microbes, because the problem is at both the medical level and also at the consumer patient level. There are parents who think, if my child doesn't get an antibiotic, my child's going to be deprived. I want the benefit of the antibiotic. And there are the doctors who also believe that the antibiotic is very useful because nobody was calculating the cost. They were only seeing the benefit of having an antibiotic. Nobody was thinking about long-term costs, the fact that taking an antibiotic might make a child more prone to asthma or to inflammatory bowel disease, as has been shown. Our work has shown taking an antibiotic gave kids an increased likelihood of developing obesity. It's not that every child who took an antibiotic became obese, but comparing children who took antibiotics with those who didn't, there was an increased propensity for obesity.
And we know in livestock that antibiotics, one of the reasons antibiotics is given is to fatten the animals.
Yeah, that's the main reason that farmers are using antibiotics in the United States, is to fatten up their farm animals as growth promotion. And that's really where I got the idea more than 10 years ago. I thought, if farmers are giving antibiotics to their livestock to improve their growth, to fatten them up, what are we doing to our kids? Is this an unintended consequence? And that's why we've been doing studies in the lab in mice to see if we can make a model for this. And we have a series of models which show, just as on the farm, when we give low doses of antibiotics to the mice, they get fat.
So is one of the most common reasons people go to the doctor for an antibiotic is an upper respiratory tract infection. And you cite some interesting statistics that probably around 5% of people who have upper respiratory infections actually need an antibiotic, but 60 to 80% of them actually get one.
Yeah, it's the exact numbers are a little hard to come by and varies from study to study, but that's about the right order of magnitude. Even if you went up to 20%, I don't think anyone would think that it was higher than that from the studies that have been done. And again, in Sweden, they're much closer to the levels I'm talking about than we are. We're just over-treating. Doctors are worried about being sued. You know, if they don't give an antibiotic and the child has some ill effect, they're thinking, well, I'm going to get sued. And the parents are feeling, you know, panicky, or they're feeling my child is sick. The antibiotic is going to make them better. Whereas we know from very careful clinical trials that most of these upper respiratory infections get better all by themselves. And most of them are due to viruses. Antibiotics don't even work. But when the parent takes the antibiotic and gives the antibiotic to the child and the child gets better, they say, aha, that was due to the antibiotic. But that's not what the studies show.
Well, you also mentioned France as an interesting case study, a country that had one of the highest antibiotic uses in the world and has since gone on a campaign to reduce their antibiotic use successfully.
Yeah, they've been very successful, and it's kind of a model for us. It's antibiotics, you know, only when necessary. It's not like antibiotics every time, but only when necessary. And that's for many people in the United States. Antibiotics are controlled. You have to get a prescription from a healthcare provider. In some countries of the world, anybody can take antibiotics. So in China, they're available without prescription, and the use of antibiotics is 2 to 4 times higher than it is even in our country. But that's why we pay doctors and nurses, so that when you go there, the doctor should do a very careful exam on you or your child and decide, does this person need an antibiotic or not? And if the doctor says your child doesn't need an antibiotic, you should feel great. They've done a careful exam. The child isn't that sick. They're just going to get better by themselves.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking to Dr. Martin Blaser about his new book, Missing Microbes, How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues. Dr. Blaser, you talk about or use the metaphor of a highly evolved ecosystem to explain the role and interface of human and the bacteria that we walk around with. And I was curious about your concern around possibly losing small strains of bacteria, which I would imagine would be like endangered species in the animal world of rare species that could go extinct. What is the concern around using antibiotics and possibly having a species die out that we don't know has any potential benefit at this point?
Yeah, so what I'm talking about is somewhat theoretical, but there's also some evidence supporting what I'm about to say. The rules of ecology are the same whether you're talking about macroecology, forests and prairies, or microecology, talking about the microscopic niches within the human body. And we know in general that healthy ecosystems have a lot of biodiversity. There isn't one dominant organism, and there are exceptions to this, and that nature has worked that one out very well. But what we know, for example, in the human body is that we have some, you mentioned this idea that we have 100 trillion bacteria in our body, and that's about the order of magnitude. That's correct. Some of the organisms, we have trillions of them, and some we have billions, and some we have millions, and some we have thousands. And my concern is that every time you take an antibiotic, it may be that a few of the species that we have might be going extinct. Not the organisms that are present in the trillions, but the ones that may be present in the thousands or the hundreds, and that we are losing biodiversity. Comparisons have now been made between people in the U.S. and people in certain developing countries, and we have evidence that we have lost biodiversity. Right now, we don't know what the consequence of that is. One possibility is that there's no consequence. Another possibility is that it's actually good. I don't think so. I think that this biodiversity is ancient. It's been part of how we've been living since time immemorial. and ecological theory tells us biodiversity is good. And another very important point is that we know that the bacteria in our body, which we could call the good bacteria, are very important in protecting us against the bad bacteria, against invaders. Scientists have shown that if they treat a mouse, if they give salmonella to a mouse, it takes a lot of salmonella to infect the mouse. But if they pre-treat the mouse with antibiotics and mess up their gut ecosystem, they mess up the bacterial populations that are present, and then give salmonella, it takes many fewer. It may take 10,000-fold fewer salmonella to make the mouse sick. And that's evidence of how our normal, healthy bacteria are protecting us against invaders.
Another interesting part of this that seems to be at issue because of our incomplete and our incomplete knowledge around what the bacteria do and which ones are beneficial and which ones aren't is the case study of H. pylori, which we originally believed was solely a negative thing, something that caused ulcers, increased our risk of stomach cancer, but now we're realizing may actually have an upside to it, which complicates the picture. Can you talk to us a little bit about the journey around H. pylori and what its implications are?
Yeah, I'm happy to. And in fact, the journey about H. pylori is like the last 30 years of my life. So so H. pylori was discovered in the early 1980s to live in the human stomach. And it was found that people who had the organism had increased risk of getting ulcers. And in fact, if you treated people to eradicate H. pylori, their ulcers went away. So that was a huge advance. It changed the treatment of ulcers, just turned it around overnight. And we showed, actually I was one of the people who showed, that having this organism promoted people getting stomach cancer, which is a terrible, terrible disease. So everything was painting H. pylori as being very black and very bad for humans. And for many years, even to the present, the general dogma among doctors is that the only good Helicobacter is a dead one. But we, as I said, I've been working on this for 30 years, and about 20 years ago, I began to think, well, maybe it's a little more complicated than that, because the organism is very ancient, and it's the dominant organism in the human stomach when it's present. And then I realized, by looking at different statistics and doing our own studies, that H. pylori was disappearing, that it was an organism that was once highly prevalent, that everybody used to have it, and now it's disappearing. And in fact, H. pylori is my model for the missing microbe, the disappearing microbe. So the good news is that ulcer disease is going away, stomach cancer is going away as it's disappearing, but now new diseases are arising, like diseases of the esophagus, such as esophageal reflux or GERD, and Barrett's esophagus, and a new and also terrible form of cancer, adenocarcinoma of the esophagus, which was once a very rare cancer, which is increasing dramatically.
And can we link the increase of that to the absence of H. pylori, or is it just a correlation at this point?
Well, it's a temporal correlation. As H. pylori is going down, these diseases are going up. But we've done a number of studies, and other investigators have done studies showing that people who have H. pylori are less likely to get these diseases, indicating that H. pylori is protective. There have now probably been 50 studies that have shown this, although it hasn't really changed the practice of medicine for reasons that I'm unclear about. And we've also shown that having H. pylori protects against asthma, especially childhood onset asthma, not the asthma that people get when they're 20, but the asthma that people get when they're 3. And there have been studies in humans, and now there have been studies in mice that really confirm this. And these are just two examples. But so the story with H. pylori is more mixed. There's definitely biological cost to having the organism in terms of ulcer disease and stomach cancer, but there also seems to be benefit. And most of the benefit seems to be early in life. So we think H. pylori is good for us when we're young, and it's generally bad for us when we're old.
Well, it's also interesting about childhood onset diabetes, the autoimmune type of diabetes, and the fact that it's more common in children who are children of C-sections, in boys who are tall, and in babies who gain weight more rapidly, which all of those things are things that there's a higher likelihood that they've that children have been exposed to more antibiotics than shorter kids because it increases growth, and heavier kids because it increases growth. Can you talk a little bit about antibiotics and possibly diabetes, and then what we should be doing around antibiotics during birth?
Yeah, well, let me go back a little to before birth, because as far as we know, a baby in the womb is pretty much germ-free, is pretty much sterile. And their first exposure to bacteria occurs when they're being born, when a baby is passed through the birth canal. They are coated with their mother's bacteria, the bacteria that are lining the vagina. They're coated on their skin. They swallow the bacteria. That's their introduction to the world. In fact, that's how mammals like us have been doing it for the last 150 million years, whether they're whales or elephants or mice or humans. Born vaginally means you acquire your mom's vaginal bacteria. But now C-sections have become safe about 100 years ago. And it used to be about 5% of births ended up needing a C-section. And 25 years ago in the U.S. it was 18%, and today it's 32%. So about one out of every three babies born in the United States is born by C-section. They're missing that initial exposure to their mom's vaginal microbiota. And in Brazil, it's 50%. And many other countries, it's about 50%. So we have changed how kids are born, how they're getting their initial inoculum of bacteria. So that's like the first hit. And then antibiotics are the second hit. So we have more and more evidence that we're screwing up our early life microbiota, the development of these organisms. And that leads to the theory that it's causing some of these diseases that have their onset in childhood, like juvenile diabetes. And again, working in the lab, we have evidence in mice that giving antibiotics to the mice accelerate their risk of getting diabetes.
That's really fascinating. I really enjoyed the epilogue in Missing Microbes, Dr. Blaser, around how it would have been unfathomable 100 years ago with the invention of the car that each time we turned our ignition, the polar ice caps would melt a little bit more. It would seem absurd, and yet now we know that it's true. And you're sort of asking us to take the same view each time we use antibiotics, that we should be doing a consideration around what its effect is on the whole, both our whole bodies, but also our the human and global community. Could you just touch base briefly on some other areas around solutions that people should focus on?
Well, for us, the main solution is to keep doing research so we understand what's going on, for people to be much more judicious in their use of antibiotics. You know, when a child is sick, and the doctor says this child needs antibiotics, you don't disagree, because antibiotics could be life-saving. But there are a lot of cases in the gray, and there are a lot of cases where the doctor says, no, this child doesn't need antibiotics, and the parents insist, I want antibiotics. I'm telling you that these cases have cost, and that parent may not be doing a favor to their child. Same thing about C-section. Sometimes it's life-saving. Most of the time it's not. Many times it's not necessary. So we have to have better dialogue with our doctors about that. Ultimately, we may have to restore some of those missing microbes. In 1998, I suggested that we're going to be giving H. pylori back to children to replace their ancient organism that has been lost. I believe that today, and even more so.
That's very interesting, and I'm imagining potentially banning antibiotics in livestock like they've done in Europe should be at least on the table for discussion.
Sure. I mean, one of the aspects of the widespread use of antibiotics on the farm is that trace amounts of it are getting into our meat and our milk, and in some communities into their drinking water, because their drinking water intakes are downstream of the effluent from industrial farms. So what's the effect of exposure of millions and tens of millions of people to trace levels of antibiotics? We have no idea. It's never been studied, but it needs to be studied.
Well, Dr. Blaser, it was a pleasure having you on Health Watch today.
Thank you so much.
We're talking today to Dr. Martin Blaser, the author of Missing Microbes, How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues. You've been listening to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Vietnam, an interview, a live performance and book release event on Saturday, August 9th, 6 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1034 Southwest 13th Avenue in Portland. The presentation will feature live original music, music videos, dramatic readings, and a discussion with the producers. That's Vietnam, an interview, in commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the Tonkin Gulf Resolution, Saturday, August 9th, 6 p.m., at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Interested in solar power? In saving the planet and money on your electricity bill? In creating millions of good jobs? Celebrate the just-completed solar power electricity installation at the Musicians Union Hall on Sunday, August 17th, from 3 to 7 p.m. You'll have a chance to see the rooftop solar unit. Learn about how you can do it on your home or business. There will be food, children's games, displays, and lots of music from the likes of Dave Rovix. Again, that's Sunday, August 17th, from 3 to 7 p.m. at the Musicians Union Hall, 320 Northeast 20th in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm.